I was about to have a child and discovered that Rod and my to-be-born child ended up having the same birthday. And I used to needle Rod once a year on that birthday and say, my kid is 2 years old. He can climb couches. Can your robots do that? And similarly, until my child was 4 years old, and I decided it was so far ahead of the robots that it was no fair to needle Rod anymore.
Welcome to the MIT Catalysts, a podcast series by the MIT Club of Northern California. Each episode, host Julia Yu interviews MIT alumni, faculty, and affiliates who are movers and shakers in the Bay Area.
We're excited to have two pioneers in robotics and AI with us here today, Rodney Brooks and Gary Marcus. Rodney Brooks was a co-founder of iRobot, also known for its Roomba vacuum, and Rethink Robotics. Rodney is an Australian native, which you will soon hear from his accent, and he is a professor emeritus at MIT, where he used to be director of CSAIL. Gary Marcus is a prolific and renowned author, a professor at NYU, and founder of Geometric Intelligence, which was acquired by Uber in 2016. He did his graduate education at MIT, where his advisor was Steven Pinker, one of my favorite authors. So how did you two meet and decide to work together?
We first met when I was writing an article for The New Yorker about why robotics was so hard. And I went and interviewed Rod, and I discovered that we were kind of converging on the same view about artificial intelligence being off in the wrong direction, that people are too obsessed with data and deep learning and not paying enough attention to common sense and how to make robots genuinely smart. Then I started writing a book about AI, which will be coming out soon, called Rebooting AI, and a chapter on robotics. And while I was writing that chapter on robotics, I decided it was time for me to get in the robotics game and talked to Rod a little bit about it and had a vague sense that he might be available sometime soon. And he's, of course, a legend in robotics. And, you know, I felt like we were kind of converging on a similar view. And so when I sent him the book chapter to look at, I just got this vibe that, you know, he might actually be available. So I spent a number of months courting him to try to get him to join this company that is now robust.ai, and eventually persuaded him. You'll have to ask him why he agreed to all this.
Well, Gary promised me that I would never have to do a pitch to a VC as part of this company. And after, I believe it was 27 pitches together, we were funded. So he broke his first promise.
And still you're here.
What was the tipping point?
I mean, only Rod can sense that. But I mean, from my perspective, I spent a lot of time trying to figure out what was important to Rod and what was important to me, and you know, trying to find common ground. And so we talked a bunch about what we would like to do and what we wouldn't do. I remember one line was like, not that this was a serious proposal that we were doing, but we were just trying to articulate our views. He's like, if I wanted to build a window washing robot company, I could do that. You know, Rod wanted to do something ambitious and exciting, and so did I. And so I think from my perspective, what took a while was not so much that Rod didn't like the premise of the company, which I don't think has changed too much, but that he had just been involved in another company for 10 years and he wanted to decide whether, A, it was really worth doing what we wanted to do, and B, could he really trust me, because we didn't know each other that well, and you know, was I the right person to make this commitment, and just did he want to make another commitment at all? But he'll now tell you that I'm totally wrong and he had a different idea or not.
No, I think to me the important thing, and this gets back to the window washing robot comment, was I didn't want to do anything just to start a company. I didn't need to do that. But if we were going to do something which had a chance of being iconic, then I was interested in that. iRobot, you know, turns out to be iconic. It's the first robot in people's homes, and it's the Roomba product is now just in normal English usage. People don't have to be told what a Roomba is. People know what a Roomba is. So we changed the landscape. And at my last company, although it wasn't financially successful, we did change the way people think about industrial robots. We completely changed the idea that robots before had to be caged and had to be programmed in 1980s scripting languages. We made them so that they didn't have to be caged. People would be right next to the industrial robots and people could show them what to do. And now that idea is being run with. So I wanted to only do something which I thought was going to have an impact on the world in changing what people thought was possible.
And I think that when we ran, I always agreed with that. We were very unified on that. But there were times when we went around to the VCs and we sort of heard what the VCs wanted to do. And it was always kind of a very narrow vertical. And we had to have some conversations about, are we going to push back on this? Do we, you know, how badly do we want money versus what we, you know, do we want our vision? And you know, we kept to our vision and eventually, you know, found investors that saw the same vision that they were very happy to work with. As we record this interview, we're in our lead investor space, Playground, and Peter Barrett there really got what we wanted to do and let us do it on our own terms. But we both wanted to make sure that we would not be kind of pushed too quickly to a narrow vertical that wouldn't let us build what our ambition is, which is to build a horizontal at some level that is a new way of building robots that are much smarter, much more flexible and dynamic and so forth. Really change the paradigm.
For those of us not familiar with robust.ai, could you tell us a little bit more?
Well, I mean, we've just started, I should say, in fairness. We're growing fast, so we are hiring 4 people in the next 2 weeks, basically, and which I think will bring us to 13. We've been funded for a couple of months, so we're growing quite quickly. We have a pretty clear idea of what we want to do in the first year or so in terms of building a demo. The broader vision really is to build what we call a cognitive engine. So right now, when people build robots, they tend to build them in a very ad hoc fashion. And it kind of reminds us of the early days of programming, where there are no systematic libraries, the tools are very limited. There are no off-the-shelf tools to help make your robot deal with an open-ended world. So there's a lot of emphasis on automation, but not that much emphasis or not that many tools for building robots that can really act in an autonomous fashion in, let's say, a home or a construction site doing delivery, where things are going to be changing constantly. So if you compare humans to machines right now, machines can do very narrow tasks very well. Like they can play Go better than the best human. But in open-ended tasks where you have to be flexible and think on the fly, so to speak, there are no tools there and there are no robots that can really do that well. So the best known tools in AI now are things like deep reinforcement learning, and it just doesn't work in the real world. So we want to build a set of tools to allow any company to be able to build robots that work in the real world, that are flexible, that can respond when things are not as they anticipated and still get done what you need to get done.
A lot of companies around the world are trying to make their existing machinery intelligent. They wouldn't have called it a robot before because it was operated by a person, but they're trying to make it much more autonomous now. And not all of those companies have access to the expertise that you can find in Silicon Valley or in Boston for building AI systems. And so we're trying to provide the tools which gives them that leg up, that they don't have to go and recruit an enormous team before they can get started. They can start with our software and move quickly ahead on robotifying existing equipment.
I want to go back to your early days when you started your first venture. So hindsight 2020, what do you wish you would have known about being an entrepreneur before you embarked on this wild journey?
Well, I've been an entrepreneur longer. My first company was actually started here in Silicon Valley 35 years ago this summer. And it was a software company for AI tools. It lasted 8 years before it went Chapter 11, but it had some impact on the world while it was around. And then I started a bunch of other companies that ended up with iRobot and since. I think when I first started building companies, I didn't appreciate the impact that price could have on adoption. And the thing that made the Roomba successful was, and by the way, that was our 15th business model at iRobot. We had 14 failed business models. But the thing that made us, there were two things that made the Roomba successful. The first was we were not the first company to have a robot vacuum cleaner. Electrolux was, but theirs was 2,000 euros. They hadn't yet started selling it in the US. We came out at $200. It was just a totally different price point where people could afford to buy it. Many people could afford to buy it on a sort of whim. It didn't require, oh, we have to save up for this robot vacuum cleaner. 2,000 euros was much bigger chunk to buy it off. And the other thing was, the robot vacuum cleaner didn't have to be as good a cleaner as people because it wasn't competing against human cleaners. It was competing in apartments where people didn't clean at all. So it only had to clean a little bit to be a big improvement. And so I think that was it took a long time to come to those lessons. But you can when you want to create a new market, the price can be critical. Because people are not too sure it's going to work out so well. And so, you know, they don't want to really invest a high amount of capital in it. So how do you get a benefit to the end user at a low cost?
I want to push a little bit more on what you mentioned about succeeding on the 15th try. You know, at what point do you keep going and keep borrowing money from angels, friends, and family and keep pushing versus pivot versus walk away? Was it clear to you, after the 14th time, or what was your thought process?
Well, that iRobot had come after my first VC-funded company, and so we did it without any VC. So we had zero investment for many, many years, and we made sure that everything we did paid for itself as we went, although my gold credit card helped a lot along the way. So we were not, we didn't have massive amounts burnt capital. We only started taking capital about 9 years in, and the Roomba came out at 12 years in, and then the IPO was 15 years in. So it was a overnight success. But we had the luxury of not having burnt through capital because of our business model was we had to get paid up front for everything we did for the first 10 years or so.
I've only had one company before this, and we more or less did what we intended to do. We borrowed a page from Demis Hassabis's DeepMind. We were inspired by DeepMind, and I've told Demis that we were borrowing from his game plan. We assembled a very bright crew of machine learning and AI researchers, and we developed some interesting intellectual property, and we were purchased for that rather than for a product that we had. And my team formed the nucleus of Uber AI Labs. And that was pretty much what we thought would happen, and I think it worked pretty well, and you maybe learn more lessons if things don't go well. I do think that the nature of that company is very different from this company, and I learned something from how that company went that, you know, hopefully applies here. So, I mean, we set down a culture very early that was all about research. And here, there's some research involved, but this is a company where we're building a product, and the expectations and how things get set up and so forth have to be very different. People were free to be free agents in a way in the context of research. So we had an idea, and people were able to kind of develop that in their own kind of open-ended ways. Whereas here, we're trying to build a specific demo first that has an underlying architecture that we're developing, and then ultimately a series of products. And from the beginning, the culture here is, how are we going to build this? And so there's a lot more talk about software engineering and practicalities. There is a role for research, but it's not the first-class citizen that is in the other company. Here, it's in the service of, how do we build the product? You know, how can we solve this particular puzzle? And it was good for me to have tried the other and to see how that goes. It would not apply here. And so I think one important thing one has to recognize is every company is different. And, you can't necessarily follow the same game plan twice. And especially the kinds of companies that I've been involved in, the kinds of companies that Rod's been involved in, we're trying to do things that are iconic. We're not just trying to like take an existing model and, you know, import it to another country or something like that. These are adventures that are exciting and fun because there is no exact roadmap. But that comes with anxiety at times. And we have to be prepared to pivot and so forth. But I think every company is different, and you can't just like read a textbook on building companies. Like, you have to look at the situation on the ground, and the situation on the ground constantly changes, right? Competitor comes out with something, or you get this fabulous new employee, or you don't get this fabulous employee that you wanted, or, you know, something falls through. So, you know, from the taste I got of running the first company, I learned how much of it is about being nimble and responsive and so forth.
And how was your experience going through the acquisition?
My least favorite part of the process, partly because it's lonely, to be honest. I got, I had a number of CEOs from other companies were investors in my company, and they sort of served as my mentors. And they all said, don't tell your employees. And I think it was good advice. Don't tell your employees you're in an acquisition process for two reasons. One is they get distracted. They start pricing out speedboats and stuff like that, trying to figure out, do they have enough equity to buy, you know, a boat of this size or whatever? And the other is it might not work. Right? I mean, the acquisition might not go through, and then everybody is demoralized. And so I spent like 4 months or something like that, only really being able to talk to my wife and my CTO, and not really being able to tell the team what was going on, and not really being there with the team. And so I got a little distant from the team, because I was always on the road talking to, you know, potential bidders. We had a bunch of people that were interested in the company, and that had its own intrinsic ups and downs. Like, you know, you think that the sale is about to go through, and then somebody pulls out and somebody else comes in, but it's a little different. And it was kind of a lonely moment, and it was tense. You know, there's more zeros attached to things than I was accustomed to. I actually consulted my friend Annie Duke, who was a world champion poker player. Like, how do you even deal? Like, she, in the course of her profession, she's now retired from it, but in the course of her profession, she would have to place bets of like $500,000 or $1 million. And she's like, you just have to stop thinking about the value of the money and just, you know, it's a mental exercise, and you have to detach yourself. You're trying to make the best deal possible, but, you know, like, one day the price goes up by $5 million or $50 million or whatever, and the next day it goes down by the same amount. You just have to, like, have a certain kind of detachment. And so to do that while you can't really talk to your friends that you built the company with, that was hard. So not my favorite part of the process.
I'd like to add to that. My last company, Rethink Robotics, had actually an acquisition offer back in 2016, which was a pretty hefty acquisition. And some people on the board said, well, really, we should be a unicorn. And so then we started a process, which ended up scaring off the first offer. And then people in the company got the idea that we were, you know, on the market. And then I think they sort of dropped the ball on, we got to be profitable. It became, we got to be acquired. And a chain of things happened, and we ended up doing neither, which wasn't fun. I think definitely, you know, acquisition, first, being too greedy on acquisition is a bad thing. And secondly, acquisition in the air is not good for the team, in my experience.
We actually already got feelers, and people like us as a team, we already got feelers. And I think Rod and I both thought, like, this is not what we want to be doing right now. There's a product that we want to build, and if we start having these conversations now, then, you know, we're never going to get there.
Yeah, they're always nonsensical. It's a symptom of the hype right now. You know, okay, we got an office, but we haven't written a line of code yet. Oh, you want to buy us? Okay. No.
By the way, I just want to point out, because you haven't asked about it, I think some people have this imagination that Rod is the sort of gray eminence here. And I mean, he is a gray eminence, but he sits here and writes code. He goes off to Hawaii on vacation and he writes code. So there was a period in which there was no code written. Rod actually wrote our first code and worked pretty hard on it.
You're a doer.
Yeah. Yeah. It's more fun.
When did you know you would be an entrepreneur? Was it always in you, or did an apple strike you from the tree?
I mean, for me, it was literally the moment when DeepMind sold. I really had not thought about running a company before. At that point, I was writing about AI. I had a kind of regular gig with The New Yorker, and I was saying everybody's kind of doing this wrong. And I was supposed to have dinner with a guy who was actually involved in the acquisition, who was, well, I guess I can't go into the details, but it's like, sorry, I'm late for dinner. I was involved in this deal. I can't tell you about it. But I read about it the next day, and it was DeepMind. I was like, wow, that's a lot of money. And it was, you know, people plus good ideas. And I thought, I could do that. I mean, I did not execute as well as Demis, but I executed pretty well. And it did, you know, was life-changing. And so I really got the idea from that. Up until that point, I had spent most of my time as an academic and as a writer.
Well, I grew up in Australia in a very moderate household. There was nothing to suggest entrepreneurship. But I came to Stanford to do a PhD in computer science in 1977. And while I was doing my PhD, some of my fellow graduate students, you know, started Sun Microsystems. My roommate became employee number 50 of a little company up in Seattle called Microsoft. So Apple was around. So it was in the air here back then. And I went away as a postdoc to MIT. There were other companies being started there. And then I came back and I was on the faculty at Stanford, 83 to 84. And I'd been working on a piece of software. And some other people said, we could turn that into a company. And so my piece of software became the kernel of the company that we started in the summer of 1984. So I hadn't expected to be an entrepreneur. And right as we started the company here in Palo Alto, I moved back to Boston to become a professor at MIT. I had a $100,000 Sun workstation in my house, which cost $140,000 in Lexington, Massachusetts. And by day, I was an MIT professor, and at night, I wrote code for the company.
I want to talk about failure a bit, because oftentimes when we think about entrepreneurs, what's highlighted is the successes, the successful exits and acquisitions. But what isn't always in the spotlight is the struggle and the failure points, and how to push through failure, how to overcome it and get back up and have some grit.
Well, I think it goes without saying you have to be prepared for that. It's almost never easy. You do hear stories about some people whose names are well known, who have fabulously successful companies. And often they tend to think that they were brilliant, and I tend to think, no, they were really lucky. So luck plays a lot in it. Of course, you can't be lucky if you don't play the game, if you don't try, but you have to try, and it may take many, many times. So at iRobot, our 14 failed business models just let us know that we had to keep trying, and at the same time, we had to make payroll, and we most months we didn't know how we're going to make the next payroll for the first 10 years. So that made us sort of a mixture of daring and cautious at the same time. So we had to evaluate our bets very carefully, and then they all went wrong. But eventually, we got lucky.
And probably most successful entrepreneurs are incredibly persistent people. Just in a different domain, I had a stretch where I think I submitted 13 academic articles and got them all rejected or something like that, but didn't give up and eventually got things in Science and Nature and so forth. And my first three books didn't do that well, and my fourth was on the bestseller list. Like, you know, and Rod's first company, I guess, folded, and he went out and built iRobot, which, you know, IPO'd and became an enormous thing. So, you know, I think both of us are willing to work hard and to pivot and try again. And I think that, you know, if you can't do that, you probably shouldn't be an entrepreneur.
Who is your inspiration?
What inspires this company is wanting to see AI really be genuinely useful. And so it's a desire to solve a particular problem. And I guess in general, I think AI is off course right now, and it's something that I'm passionate about. I would like to see it help society. And right now, I think it's just kind of data dredging, and the data dredging is leading to like software that discriminates against people and face recognition systems that don't really work. And rather than having another AI winter, which I think is a possibility, I would like to see AI actually earn its keep in society. My new book, Rebooting AI, is about that. It's like, how do we get AI in the right place? And so it's a kind of vision, I guess, that's inspiring me right now, that AI could be so much more than it is right now. And I think robotics is a perfect place to try to execute on that vision.
Well, I'm way older than Gary. I found myself with the current hype cycle that's going on in AI, becoming the grumpy old man who writes about, just hold on, it's not as fantastic as you think, it's going to take longer to deploy. We're not going to have self-driving taxis last year. It's going to take a while. And I wasn't enjoying being the naysayer, but I thought it's important to reset people's expectations, because I think they've gotten completely out of control on both AI and robotics. And so that, you know, people worry about all sorts of things happening, which are just so far off in the future, we can't see anything sensible. So I wanted to do something, you know, positive. And so I sort of joke, but I'm sort of serious, that I thought if we could build a company that could deliver 1% of what has been promised for AI, that would be a big change in the world. So that's what I want to do with this company.
So what I'm hearing, Rod, is that a lot of the fears around AI and a lot of the negativities you think are exaggerated.
I think the negativity and the fears of super intelligent AI is exaggerated. I think what we see instead, and it's real, are a couple of things. One is data sets being used for learning, which lead to things like, you probably have read about the automatic scanning of CVs at Amazon at one point, which was excluding women. That's not a good thing. So it's the dumb AI that I'm more worried about. And on the other side, it's just general security of computer systems. I think it's not malevolent computer systems. It's just crappy computer systems are what we should be afraid of. They're being exploited by real humans who are really evil, and that's what we have to worry about.
Right now, if the robots come from you, first thing you should do is close the door, because robots right now can barely open doors. So after I wrote this line for the book, somebody released a data set with 500 different doors that you could put in your simulator, and they released it because it's not really that well solved problem. And then sentence two in the book is like, and if that doesn't work, lock the door. I mean, we're nowhere near robots that can like fit in a key and, you know, move the key and wiggle it and stuff like that. So I have exactly the same view, I think, as Rod here. And it's interesting because we came to this view from different places. So Rod has come to his views from watching a lot of robots fail in the real world, among other things. And I've come to this view from looking at cognitive science and feeling like we're just not doing these things in ways that make sense relative to what human beings are doing. And we've converged on exactly the same place, which is we really don't need to worry about superhuman intelligence anytime soon. We need to worry about software that's actually too dumb, but that we're trusting as if it were able to make good decisions about employment or the power grid or whatever, when these systems don't have a lot of depth to them. So they rely on statistics, and those statistics are kind of superficial, and they work, you know, on Monday and Tuesday, but they might not work on Wednesday. The systems don't really understand why the statistics are there. The old notion of causation versus correlation is basically, to a first approximation, correct. These current systems are mostly doing correlation. They don't understand the underlying causation, which means they can't really solve the problems that we want them to solve. And so the problem is not too much intelligence. It's actually too little that's being trusted too much.
And Rod, I recall in a previous interview, you were talking about the age of robots, right? So can a robot do what a four-year-old does today or a six-year-old? Where do you think we are today? And where do you think we'll be in 10 years?
I wasn't saying that we could get robots at a certain age, but I said good aspirations were the visual object recognition capabilities of a two-year-old child. A two-year-old child can recognize something by its function rather than its form. They're much more general than the current deep learning labeling system. So visual capabilities of a two-year-old child, the speech capabilities of a four-year-old child, they can do all sorts of counterfactuals and reason about things. Not as smart as an adult, but still way better than any of our AI programs. The manual dexterity of a six-year-old child. A six-year-old child can tie shoelaces, something that we just can't do with robots. And they can do it in all sorts of situations. And finally, the social understanding of an eight-year-old child. An eight-year-old child essentially has a theory of mind and can know that the other person can know things that are wrong compared to what the child knows, or vice versa. So I'm not saying that we're close to having any of those capabilities. I just think they're worthy goals for AI researchers to go after, rather than, you know, get the next data set and build the next set of labels. Look for the mechanisms that would enable those four different capabilities.
What is the most exciting and the scariest thing in AI right now?
I think the most exciting thing is it's a great moment of opportunity. We can bring together a bunch of tools for the first time that have never been brought together. So deep learning is a much better way of recognizing individual objects than we've had before. And we have way more compute than we have before. There are a bunch of areas that are being neglected right now, like classical artificial intelligence, but it's a good moment to bring all these things together. There's kind of a history of bad blood in the field where people have pursued these things independently, but there's a real opportunity now to try to build an original synthesis. So I think that's exciting, and it's obviously part of what we're thinking about at Robust. What's scary to me is so much of the field is just concentrated on what I can do with a bigger data set, and bigger data sets don't necessarily give you deeper understanding. And so, you know, stuff gets rolled out, but it really shouldn't be. Like there was an example of a face recognition system in China that was set up to give people tickets for jaywalking. And it gave a ticket to a celebrity whose picture was on the side of a bus because the system recognized that she seemed to be moving in the street. But it didn't have the, you know, common sense to recognize that a picture on the side of a bus is not actually a person.
What about you, Rod?
Well, I think a cynic's view of AI could say that the reason we've been successful for the last 50 years is we've had Moore's Law as our companion, and we've just gotten more and more computation. So we haven't had to be really clever. Now, Moore's Law has come to an end, but the cloud is getting bigger and bigger, so we have more and more computation. But then you see interesting things like little tiny drones, where you can't, you know, you can only carry a tiny little processor with you. And so we're starting to see interesting work, such as at the electrical engineering department at MIT, Vivian Tsai. She's been architecting very low power chips to be on drones to do some of the things that up till today have required the cloud. So I think there's a sort of a golden age now where people could be really creative if they want to be. And I'm hoping that people will be really creative and we'll see some new ideas come into the field. Maybe they'll just be lazy and that won't happen. But I've got confidence in young faculty members.
I can just jump in on that. It's very seductive to just get the bigger data sets because right now that is paying off. And so people are not trying to be creative because they have these tools in front of them that give a lot of short-term rewards. And so we need people to both be creative and to think a little bit more long-term than they are right now. And because the economics are such that if you solve commercial problems right now, there's so much money to be made for like a young person with a PhD in machine learning. I think some people are getting distracted from the real problems. I think it's right that we are enabled to be more creative than before. So, you know, when Marvin Minsky was hacking away in the 1960s, if you had 64K of RAM, that was a lot. And now you can, you know, you have 64 gigabytes at your disposal and you can have a whole cluster of GPUs. So, and there were no big data corpora then. And now there's, you know, many, many. So there are enabling conditions that really did not exist in the early days. So people could be doing interesting things, but those very enabling conditions are also keeping them at the moment from having to work hard to come up with creative ideas. Hopefully that will change soon.
What advice do you have for entrepreneurs today trying to get money?
I have two pieces of advice. The first is that every situation is different. So we had very particular reasons for why we wanted to take a seed round rather than a Series A. We were actually offered a Series A. But we decided that seed round worked better for us, and that had to do with our time scale and economics, all kinds of things. And so there's no like, you know, if you get a Series A, you should take it kind of rule like that. The second thing is just it always takes longer than you want. You need the money more than they need the investment. So you want to get started tomorrow and they want to make sure they're really getting the best deal. And so it's always going to take more months than you think in order to get the money that you actually need.
All right. So what books are you reading right now, if you have time to read?
There's an old joke, and one dean says to the other, what are you going to do when you're about to retire? And the other one says, I'm going to finish my book. And the first one says, well, what are you writing? And the other one says, writing? No, I just meant I'm going to finish reading a book. Right now, I'm not really reading a lot, to be honest. I'm reading some very narrow professional stuff, but I have this startup. I just finished a book, and so I have to market that book. And then I have two little children, and that's enough for me. So I'm not reading as much as I once did.
Whereas I'm writing a book, and it requires a lot of research. So I am reading lots and lots of books. I was reading a book from 1619 in Latin 2 weeks ago. So it's a very broad range of things about computation, things about origins of life, things about human psychology. So I'm reading lots and lots of books right now. In between intense coding sessions for the company.
Great. So the way we end podcast episodes is asking, what is your startup secret sauce?
I think the secret sauce that makes this company amazing is the team. We just have an incredible team. And we've been rolling out new people every week or two, and just each one of them come in and we're like, wow, this person is really great.
I think it's getting really good people and helping them understand what they're good at and letting them tell us what they're good at and then finding a way to make that work and to build the team with great people from early days.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Rodney Brooks and Dr. Gary Marcus. It was such a pleasure to have you on our episode, and we look forward to seeing where robust.ai goes.
Thanks very much for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for tuning into this episode of the MIT Catalysts. This episode was hosted by Julia Yu and produced by me, Irina Fisher Huang. Special thanks to our guests Rodney Brooks and Gary Marcus for taking the time to chat with us. Be sure to check out Gary's latest book, Rebooting AI, Building Artificial Intelligence We Can Trust, which he co-wrote with Ernest Davis and is available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and most other places where books are sold. Thanks also to the MIT Club of Northern California, which sponsors this podcast. Make sure to subscribe to our podcast through Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. Until next time, we're the MIT Catalysts.